Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-12-109, State v. David, arguing for petitioner Craig W. Jerome, Deputy Public Defender, arguing for respondent James M. Anderson, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Mr. Jerome. Mr. Anderson, are you both ready to proceed? All right. Mr. Jerome, we'll give you a warning when we get to 5 minutes left in your argument. Mr. Anderson, you didn't ask for a warning, and the, I guess, optimistic view that you probably won't need the whole 30 minutes, but we'll see. But in any event, we won't have any flashing lights in front of you. Very well. Please proceed, Mr. Jerome.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Deputy Public Defender Craig Jerome, appearing on behalf of petitioner defendant Peter David in this case. I'd like to thank the court for taking the time this morning to hear Mr. David's case. You know, the last few months have really highlighted what can happen when people lose faith in the fairness, integrity, and equality of the institutions by which the government exercises power over its people. And that's been a nationwide thing, and it would be nice to think that that wasn't the case in our multicultural island state, but unfortunately it appears that there are times that that may be called into question, and I think this is one of those cases. You know, I really believe that this case will have far-reaching implications and will really set the standard as far as what sort of quality of justice our citizens can expect in the judiciary in this state. We presented two questions to this honorable court in our application for writ of certiorari. The first was whether the ICA gravely erred in holding that the trial court did not abuse its discretion by allowing the state to present the testimony of two rebuttal witnesses in this case. The second is, given the egregious misconduct by the deputy prosecuting attorney at sentencing, whether the ICA gravely erred in remanding this case for resentencing before a different judge rather than for a new trial.
But wasn't that your request to the ICA, that it be remanded for resentencing, not for a new trial?
You know, the specific request in our opening brief was that at a minimum it should be remanded for resentencing, which, you know, we didn't specifically argue for a new trial, but we did say that that was the minimum relief that we were requesting.
Then how do you define this injustice that occurred by remanding it for a resentencing?
Well, the first point I'd like to make is that, you know, it's clear that the prosecutor engaged in significant egregious misconduct during sentencing. Completely unacceptable misconduct, and made a completely unacceptable race-based argument to the judge as far as why he was asking for a 20-year sentence in this case. And the first point, the first thing we're asking is that this court recognize that the misconduct in this case goes beyond the mere statements that were made by the prosecutor. The real misconduct is the animus and bias that underlies those statements. I mean, it's one thing to say something and to say, well, you know, the jury never heard this statement, so it didn't affect the outcome of the trial in this case.
Is there anything in the record to indicate that racial bias or the issue of race was injected into any other phase of the trial other than sentencing?
Well,
and if so, please tell us where that occurred.
One of the very first things that the prosecutor said in his opening statement was, this case involves a particular Micronesian family in White Poppy. It has nothing to do with anything to do with the case, the fact that this is a Micronesian family. And then if you look at the actual statements that the prosecutor makes at sentencing, that's basically, if you look at the entire record, that's the state's theory of the case at trial. Is essentially that, you know, here's these two Micronesian males, everyone's at the party, everybody's drinking, they get violent with family members. The females that are present at the party, there's no females at the party that are drinking. I mean, that's emphasized again and again by the prosecutor during his case in chief.
So there was, are you suggesting, I'm sorry, Justice Pollack, but just are you suggesting we should imply from the way that the prosecution presented its case that it was a racially motivated theory, well, as opposed to any specific statement, as opposed to any overt evidence that that was the case?
Well, there's two things that I'm asking. The first is that I don't believe the burden should be on the defendant to prove that this demonstrated racial bias affected other parts of the trial. I think the burden should be on this. At a minimum, the burden should be on the state to prove that it didn't.
Nobody's asking you to prove anything. We're just asking for a record citation. as to what evidence there was that there is this racial animus that's kind of, I guess your argument is kind of pervading the process that that leads to this injustice.
The evidence is the prosecutor said this during sentencing.
Other than the sentencing, but during the, I think Justice Wilson said, what about the trial? Is there anything in the trial?
Well, what we're asking this court basically to do is to recognize, you know, either that the state must demonstrate that this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, or what we're...
This being what happened, I'm sorry, I'm not clear what this is.
The prosecutorial misconduct, which is the standard that's always been accepted for prosecutorial misconduct.
With regard to the sentencing?
With regard to the entirety of the proceedings.
So the state must prove that the prosecutorial misconduct that occurred in sentencing did not somehow affect the rest of the trial. Is that the proposition you're arguing?
The actual relief that we're asking for is for this court to hold that this is a structural error. That once the government's prosecutor, once the agent of the government has expressed racial bias or animus or contempt for the specific defendant in a case, that that's a structural error that can never be harmless. Either under the structural error analysis that's President Kramer but through this court or through Chapman's recognition that there are some constitutional errors that are of such a magnitude that they can never be harmless.
Have you found any cases that have granted that relief based solely on comments that were made in the course of sentencing?
I have not. And I realize that what we're asking for is for sort of a novel approach or a radical approach. But I think that the misconduct is so significant in this case that that's the only approach that really has any effect. You know, there's three basic primary concerns. The first is protecting Mr. David's rights to equal protection, due process, and a fair trial. The second concern that this court should be concerned with is protecting the public's perception of the fairness and integrity of the judicial system in this state. And that's a significant concern, and this court has recognized repeatedly that that's a significant concern. And the third thing this court needs
But can
to
that not be done through statements in, for example, the ICA's opinion or this court's opinion? I mean, the ICA indicated that this was an improper argument, correct?
It indicated that it's an improper argument, but what's the effect that the public sees?
The argument is characterized by the appellate court as being an improper argument and sentencing, and the case is remanded for sentencing before a new judge.
And
is that the argument? Your contention is that will not adequately meet the needs of indicating to the public that this is a system that has the appropriate level of integrity, or
no? Because this is such a pernicious statement, so antithetical to the notion of due process and a fair trial and equal protection.
You didn't raise these issues in terms of statements and opening statements, for example, in your brief to the ICA, did you?
They weren't specifically raised.
It was all about the sentencing phase, not about what happened in the trial.
Well, if you look at, there are things that were raised before the ICA that had to do with what happened during the trial. For instance, the calling of the two rebuttal witnesses was
right, but in terms of the improper, and I agree, highly improper and outrageous references to the Micronesian community, you didn't raise that with respect to what happened at trial. It was only with respect to the sentencing phase.
That's true. I don't think that the argument was as articulate as it could have been in our opening brief as far as how this demonstrates what happened in the trial. And I think it's only when you look back through the record carefully that you see the overreaching that took place during this trial, the repeated misconduct that took place during this trial. I mean, we did raise two.
Are you equating all misconduct with racial or ethnic-based misconduct?
No. Okay. But what I'm saying is that we have to look at the sentencing argument and determine whether that was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt at the trial.
Suppose that it had occurred instead of sentencing. Suppose that it occurred at a motion to increase bail. Suppose that it occurred at a motion to revoke probation. Where are we going to draw this line that we're going to go retroactively back and try to perceived motives from something that occurred in a whole different context.
Well, if it had happened at a stage that was prior to trial, I think that the defense certainly would have moved to have the prosecutor removed from the case.
If it had occurred in some preliminary motion, and there had been no motion to disqualify, and then you go through trial, and if you lose at trial, then you argue that the trial was tainted? Is that the...
Well, that would be a different factual circumstance, but that's not the factual circumstance that's before us. The animus and the bias isn't revealed in this case until after the trial's taken place, but it happens before the conviction. The conviction takes place when the defendant is sentenced. So this isn't, we're not looking at a post-conviction remedy or something where it's 2 years down the line at a motion to revoke probation. We're looking at something that, this is all part and parcel of the prosecution of the defendant in this case. It's a critical stage of the proceeding, and it happens before the conviction takes place.
Now, you're, one of the things that you're justifying on it is a statement that, I guess, an opening about a Micronesian family. Now, could not the explanation equally have been because there was going to be Micronesian interpreters and the prosecutor was trying to indicate that those were some of the things that may be, I mean, what you're trying to make, it seems to me, make comments be racially based upon a statement at sentencing that seems to me that it's hard to interrelate the two.
Well, the question is this statement at sentencing.
It would have been more proper for it to be two keys, right? I mean, there's saying that there's two Micronesian men is just like saying there was a fight between two Europeans.
That's correct. Or two Polynesians.
Or two Africans or two Asians.
That's correct. And, you know, that's part of the problem. And I think the thing is we're talking about something that happened at sentencing. So we're stuck in a point where are we trying to determine whether this is something that's the personal beliefs of the prosecuting attorney? Does he hold these deep-seated contempt for Chukchi's males or Micronesian males? And if he does, how does that affect the way that he handled the rest of this case? You know, Stacey Rogan talks about the power imbalance that exists in the criminal justice system. The prosecutors decide who to charge. They decide what to charge them with. They decide whether or not they're going to engage in plea negotiations with the defendant, what plea offers they're going to make to a defendant, what type of sentencing alternatives they're going to make to a defendant. And then when they step into a courtroom, they step into the courtroom not as a representative of an ordinary party speaking for themselves or speaking for their client. They speak for the state. They speak for the government.
But wouldn't the time to raise that have been right there at the sentencing hearing? I mean, what did the defense counsel at that point say, Your Honor, in view of these outrageous statements, I'm making an immediate motion for a new trial?
No, the defense counsel did not, and that's why we asked the court to recognize plain error. And part of that is the way that a sentencing hearing typically takes place. I mean, people are not typically objecting to prosecutors' arguments during sentencing hearings.
Perhaps they should,
and certainly there's an argument to me that we should have in this case. But if we're looking at this misconduct, and we're looking at is this misconduct harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, I think we need to look at the other misconduct that took place throughout this trial, which is...
Is the entire opening statement a part of the record?
Yes, the entire opening statement's a part of the record. And there's...
Other than the instance you mentioned, which is the reference in opening statement, anything else that you see in this record that you believe indicates what you would characterize as an inappropriate reference to race?
Well, I mean, I think that the fact that the family in this case is Micronesian or Chukchi's or however it's characterized is prevalent throughout the trial. I mean, it's repeatedly referenced throughout the trial. It's not, I mean, he asks.
So in other words, if this was two Caucasians in Kahala, there would not have been that repeated reference.
And if it was two African Americans, I don't think the prosecutor would get up and ask the Tarakis Kiku in this case, you know, are you African American? you know, where are you from, where were you raised?
He asked that question?
Well, he asked them specifically about where they came from. Did they know? I mean, there's questions about their backgrounds and when they came to Hawaii. And I mean, that, it's throughout the trial. But that, you know.
Was there an objection to that being irrelevant?
No.
I mean, that would be a common objection at that point, correct? If questions are being asked of a particular witness, where were you born, for example, I mean, could object on the grounds of relevancy?
I mean, I think you could object on the grounds of relevance, but I don't think it generally happens.
Was that information not elicited from your client on direct?
It was, but that's after the state's already presented its case.
Those witnesses are witnesses who are testifying through an interpreter, correct? Wasn't Ms. Kiku?
At least partially through an interpreter.
Right. So is that, could that be legitimately understood as an attempt to have the jury understand why an interpreter is necessary, why, for example, this witness might need the assistance of an interpreter?
It could be. And the problem is that retrospectively, once this bias is revealed, then it calls into question all these other choices that were made. It calls into question a lot of the overreaching that took place in this case. You know, this sort of, what I would characterize as trying to secure a conviction at all costs, the failure to abide by Rule 16, the statement during an opening statement.
But you haven't raised that here, this Rule 16 issue.
No,
is that?
But the state agreed and the ICA agreed that that was misconduct on the part of the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And I think it goes to the question of whether or not, looking at the entirety of the record in this case, this court can feel secure that due process and a fair trial was given.
Well, why don't we focus a bit on the rebuttal witness, because that is an area you, I think, have identified. What is it about the court's handling of the issue of those two rebuttal witnesses, and in particular start with Officer Wu, that you seek to have us address here?
Might I interrupt? And just to ask for a little bit more clarification, as the Chief Justice has said on this issue of rebuttal, because it's my understanding that under Duncan, you are concerned about an issue being raised during rebuttal that the government should have known about ahead of time. Essentially, your concern is that this evidence pertaining to self-defense was raised at a late stage. So I wanted to ask you, in terms of your position that the government should have known about the nature of the self-defense, when would that have been? When during the course of the case do you think the government was on notice that the issue of self-defense would be raised?
Well, with regard to the issue of self-defense, I know that several of the members of this court were trial judges. At the pretrial conference, the initial form that's filled out that indicates how many witnesses, how long the trial is supposed to take, that listed self-defense as the defense at that time. And then prior to trial, the defense filed a notice of basically an HRE 404B notice saying that it intended to introduce evidence of the decedent's prior bad acts in order to show that he was the initial aggressor in this case. The state
didn't suggest it was surprised about self-defense. The state, I believe, said it was surprised that the defendant had testified that he had not been spoken to and asked to leave by a police officer. So that was their stated reason for the need for this rebuttal testimony, is that the defendant had testified and, to the state's surprise, had testified that he had not spoken to a police officer, had not been asked to leave, and that was the purpose of having Officer Wu come in.
Yeah, and I think we're talking about...
Why is that not proper rebuttal?
We were talking about two different things. The state, when explaining its failure to abide by Rule 16, made this claim that they didn't know about self-defense.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm focusing now on the rebuttal witness and Officer Wu. Okay. What is it about what the trial court did that you now assert was plain error? Or error? Some parts were preserved, some parts were not, so... I guess is your position.
I mean, the error is that this is not proper rebuttal testimony, and I think the state sort of tried to backdoor 404B prior bad acts as saying it was an issue of credibility. But Duncan says that a party cannot, as a matter of right, offer and rebuttal evidence evidence which was proper or should have been introduced in chief, even though it tends to contradict the adverse party's evidence.
So the state's position is they were surprised that the testimony was that he had not talked to the officer. So is that, in light of that representation, why isn't it within the discretion of the trial court to allow this as rebuttal?
Because the state was the party that initially raised the issue of whether, of him speaking to the officers responding earlier in the day and him speaking to the officers. I mean, it was the state that raised that, and at the time that the state raised that, they should have known. I'm sorry.
I thought it was your lawyer, the lawyer who asked that specific question of your client.
No, but the state, through its other witnesses, through Tarakis Kiku and Arlen Ewan, raised the issue of the police coming earlier and the police talking to the defendant. And actually, when they testified, they both said that they didn't know whether the police talked to the defendant.
Right.
So
the first testimony as to whether or not the police actually talked to your client came from the direct examination from your lawyer, and he asked your client, and your client said, no, I never talked with the officer.
That's true, but it was the state that raised the issue, and it's a completely collateral issue that really has nothing to do with what happened subsequently.
Well, if it's collateral, I'm not sure that helps your argument, because it's not collateral. It is, in some sense, it's collateral to the self-defense, which is why maybe it didn't have to be elicited by the government, but it's clearly substantive as it goes directly to credibility. I mean, that was one of the few chances the government had to actually contradict a statement with that your client had said. So it seems like it directly went to his credibility.
Well, the state wasn't required to introduce the evidence in its case in chief, but they could have introduced the evidence in their case in chief. Certainly, that there would have been no evidentiary reason why they could not have introduced the testimony of both of these witnesses in their case in chief.
That wouldn't be they wouldn't have had to do a 404B, prior bad act, refusal to leave?
Well, you know, certainly there was already testimony about whether or not Mr. Sam had invited the defendant, or when he came to the house, whether he spoke to the defendant and told him he couldn't come inside. And there was no objection based on 404B on that. So the state never offered testimony.
So that's not refusing to obey a police officer, right? I mean, were you or were you not invited? Did you show up without invitation or not? That's different from a police officer telling someone to leave a scene and him refusing to do so.
And that also goes to another basis by which the introduction of this evidence was improper, because the court specifically said, I'm introducing this evidence for the limited purpose of showing whether or not the defendant spoke to the police. And then the state elicited testimony about the defendant refusing to leave, which is not the purpose for which the evidence was offered or allowed by the court, and the court gave no.
In other words, he should have stopped at, did you speak to him? Yes, I did.
Yes.
Well, you know, what kind of conversation did you have? I asked him to leave, and it could have stopped right there.
Yes. Mm,
you would say it shouldn't even have gone to the second question, correct?
Correct.
And was there an objection?
The defense counsel objected based on 404B. I mean, there are a few rapid questions, but the defense counsel says, I object, this is becoming 404B at this point, and that objection was overruled.
Wasn't that after it had come out?
Or? Yeah, it actually had come out. At least some of it had come out at that point.
Some of it had come out, but there are questions that proceed in a row, and I think that certainly if the objection had been sustained, there's defense counsel probably would have asked to strike all of that.
But even if the offer of proof is incomplete, the real test is whether or not the evidence was admissible, not whether or not the offer of proof could have been more complete. And the evidence that was elicited that he didn't talk and he didn't leave was directly responsive to what your client testified to, which was that he went back upstairs or something. He didn't. So I understand your argument about it maybe exceeded the offer of proof, but I think the real issue is whether or not it was proper rebuttal.
And with regard to the offer of proof, it didn't just exceed the offer of proof. It didn't comport with the offer of proof in any significant manner.
Well, Mr. Jerome, if I could bring you back to what Justice Pollack was focusing on, The subject matter that was the focus of the officer's testimony that was separate from the fact that the officer had in fact spoken to the defendant, that is the statement of the police officer that the defendant was belligerent or was refusing to leave. Now, with respect to that particular information, why is it your position that the government should have known about that issue ahead of time and addressed the issue of whether or not the defendant or how the defendant was acting at the time of the interaction with the officer?
Well, I think it's clear from the record that they did know about the fact that he didn't immediately leave, because they're the ones who asked the officer, did he leave? When you spoke to him, did he leave immediately? I mean, I don't know what the exact question was, but it's the state that elicits that testimony. It's not like the officer, he said, oh, did you speak to the defendant? And the officer said, yeah, I spoke to him, and he refused to leave. And I also want to clarify that the officer never testified that he spoke to the defendant. The officer testified that he spoke to two males, one of whom is, there's no description for whatsoever, and the other of whom is described only as a Micronesian male with a ponytail. And
was there any testimony as to how many people were in that parking lot?
No. There's no testimony about whether there were other people in the parking lot. There's no and certainly, you know,
But there's ample testimony from the other witnesses who were there, Ms. Kiko and Ms. Ellen, who both testified that the defendant and the decedent were in the parking lot with the police.
They didn't testify that the defendant and the decedent were the only people in the parking lot. They didn't testify. They both specifically testified that they did not know whether the officer spoke to the two men downstairs. Arlene Ewan said, we were in the room, the door was closed, we heard the police come, they knocked on the door, Ewan went out and spoke to the police, then they returned to the room and she shut the door again.
But isn't there enough in the record to support a finding by the trial court that, at least by a preponderance of the evidence, that the person or the testimony would be relevant to this case because it related to the defendant, based on the inferences that there were the sequence of events, the testimony of the two witnesses, that the police came, they were asked to, by at least one of them, to go downstairs to talk to the defendant and the decedent? Is that not enough? And I believe at this time the defendant had a ponytail, which he, I believe, testified to also, correct?
I'm sorry. There's nothing to indicate that the court engaged in that sort of analysis, because the offer of proof from the state is Officer Wu is going to come in and testify, and he's going to testify that he spoke to the decedent and the defendant. That was the offer of proof. The officer is going to come in and say he came at 11:30 and he spoke to Santhony and the defendant.
Now, was there an objection on that basis, Your Honor, that this was not consistent with the offer of proof?
This was on October 6, 2011, during the state's cross-examination of Mr. David. And I'm sorry, I don't have the... Okay, this is page 139. Mr. Wong is talking about the report by Mr. Wu, and nowhere does Officer Wu identify Mr. David or Mr. Albert as the specific person he talked to. What the report states is essentially the officer responded to suspicious circumstances. They came up. They remember speaking to a male who is not described, either Mr. David or Mr. Albert or someone else, and also remember speaking to a female. That's essentially what the report contains. And the judge doesn't inquire further about that. The prosecutor doesn't make any effort to amend his offer of proof. And then the record demonstrates that the prosecutor knew that the officer was not going to testify and say, I spoke to the defendant, because during his cross-examination of the defendant on October 10th at 2011 at pages 20 and 21 of the transcript, he specifically goes into the defendant whether or not he had a ponytail. And there's no reason to ask those questions if the prosecuting attorney doesn't know that his witness is just going to say, I spoke to a Micronesian man with a ponytail.
Well, the defense counsel also had that police report, right?
He did have that police report.
And he crossed, and he said that there had been, he wasn't able to identify. So both sides knew that there wasn't going to be an identification. Both sides knew there was going to be circumstantial evidence in the sense that he talked with somebody in a parking lot with a ponytail. And as Chief Justice just said, to admit that evidence, there just has to be sufficient evidence to allow a jury to make a finding that it in fact occurred.
I would disagree with that. There's nothing to indicate that the defense counsel knew that that was going to be the officer's testimony. That's not what was in his report, because I spoke to a Micronesian male with a ponytail. And the officer says this, I think, on page 79 or 80 of his testimony, that description is not in his report, Micronesian male with a ponytail. There's no description. And then he agrees that this description, this information, didn't come up until you spoke to Mr. Wong.
If the state had wanted to present evidence that Officer Wu asked the defendant to leave the scene and he refused to do so, if they had wanted to do that during his direct examination, during their case in chief, would they have been required to bring a 404B motion?
They should have been, which begs the question of why, if they introduce it in rebuttal, they're not required to do that. I see this entire rebuttal thing as an attempt to
circumvent 404B?
Yeah. Either 404B or just to enable the state to have the last word. I'm sorry, my time's up.
I'll give you some rebuttal time since we've been eating up the time you'd reserved for that purpose when we get there. Thank you, Mr. Drell. Mr. Anderson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Anderson for the state. Well, at the outset, I would, there's no way I'm going to defend or condone the prosecutor's remarks during sentencing. They were improper. I don't think they were born out of racial animus.
Have you examined the record as to the assertions of the defense here today that there's references within the trial itself that we should take plain error notice of and reverse the conviction, remand?
The initial one, in opening statement, I think that was just introductory. Here, this is what the case is about. And all the witnesses were Micronesian, so I don't see...
But there were two keys, not... Why Micronesian?
I'm sure, yes.
I mean, isn't that the same as saying European? Micronesia is huge.
No, absolutely, Your Honor. But I don't know if we all know the difference, of all the different types.
Isn't it time we educate ourselves then?
But maybe you could explain why was it useful to describe the Micronesians in that fashion? Why was it useful to add that fact that they're from Micronesia?
Well, I think because, as Justice Pollack pointed out, that there are going to be interpreters during this case, and all the witnesses were Micronesian. In fact, I think it was difficult to understand some of the witnesses. One had to be, like Kiku, for instance, had to be stopped at one point in time, and trial had to be resumed the next day because it was getting far afield. That's about it. I don't see any racial undertones in that at all. It seems absurd. But at any rate, I think the ICA correctly meted out the sanction for this case, that the case should be remanded for resentencing before a different judge, maybe a different prosecutor. Didn't say that, though. But our office does not condone that as well, because you may notice, because it's capable of ready and accurate determination by resorts to sources that can't be questioned, that our prosecutor apologized in the paper in the Star Advertiser to the Micronesian community. No, it isn't. But
okay,
you can
let's
that.
Stick to the record. Let me ask you about defense counsel's argument, which is that when something like this occurs in sentencing, the onus or the responsibility should be on the government to prove, I guess, harmless beyond a reasonable doubt that it didn't infect the trial.
Well, it couldn't have, Your Honor. It happened 3.5 months later. And it didn't happen. It wasn't spoken to the jury. The jury didn't hear anything of this nature. It was only during the...
I may have misphrased what I meant. What I meant was that his argument was that if someone has that sort of state of mind in sentencing, that the government should show that it certainly didn't exist during the trial and it didn't affect the trial. I think
Fine.
That's what the argument
Let's talk about that. I don't think there was any racial animus shown at sentencing. He didn't have the state of mind. He said, exactly, I believe I've had cases recently, and you, Your Honor, speaking to the trial judge, and you, defense counsel, have all experienced these type of cases coming down lately. And I am concerned that if we don't send a message to the Micronesian community, we won't be saving lives. This is what his intent was. He was wrongly stated because, you know, there's a little, you know, you can't send a save a...
That is not racially motivated?
No, it's not racially
motivated. How does that differ from Rogan?
Your Honor, just because you say something doesn't mean you have racial animus, hatred.
Not hatred. It means stereotyping.
No, I think animus
stereotyping.
I think animus means a hatred.
I see. So Rogan, you're conceding then, are you suggesting that in Rogan the prosecutor hated African Americans?
No. But
isn't it the issue? The issue is one of stereotyping.
I did Rogan, so I understand what happened in Rogan, Your Honor, and I understand that just that plain statement with nothing more, yeah, it could be reviewed that way. But not here. He qualified his statement.
Well, Mr. Anderson,
it was still wrong. I'm not getting around that. It was still wrong. The message was wrong.
It shows bias, doesn't it not? At least you would concede that.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if it's bias. I think it's a concern that he's been experiencing. He's been trying these type of cases, and I think it was genuine.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if there's a finding at sentencing that the prosecutor's argument does reflect racial animus or racial bias, getting back to this question about what would be the appropriate approach of the court to address that kind of prosecutorial, if you will, misconduct during sentencing, do you think there's an obligation of the court to look at the trial record at that time to make sure that the animus was not displayed during the course of the trial?
I don't. Not if there wasn't, Your Honor. I don't. He was.
Well, I'm assuming that there's a finding somewhat like the intermediate court found here that there are inappropriate statements made at sentencing that would indicate that racial overtones or bias are being demonstrated. If there is such a determination as a result of the statements at sentencing, what obligation would the court have then to look at the record at the trial?
I'm not really sure I understand your question, Your Honor. How could I don't understand it at all.
You're saying
because this happened in sentencing, the court should ensure that this didn't happen during the trial itself?
That's basically my question. Do you think there's any obligation for the court to look at the record at trial if it appears that there's a racial bias being shown at sentencing?
I think the court would notice it if it did occur.
Did defense counsel object during sentencing?
No, not at all.
And so the defense counsel not only didn't object, but would not have even asked that there had been this display of
impropriety,
such a strong impropriety to go backwards. So the court would have had to do it on its own.
True.
Well, isn't the court actually obligated to step in a situation like this?
I think it should have. Yeah, I think it should. Well, and, you know, in fact, you know, courts are very polite, as you know, and he allowed the prosecutor to finish his statement, and then said. Well, he also addressed
Unfortunately, in this case, the court actually then addressed the Micronesian community in the gallery.
I understand. But then also said, you know, I'm not intending to send a message. I'm going to sentence David on his own conduct. So, yeah, I mean, he could have called a recess, could have continued sentencing before with a different prosecutor, perhaps, or because, yeah. But he could have done a lot of things, I think. You know. But anyway, I think the ICA has hit the nail on the head and sent the case back down for resentencing. I think that's the correct sanction in this case. I don't think it infected the trial at all. I don't think there's any indication it did.
And I think you suggested that there would be no objection to an additional requirement of resentencing if that's the decision of this court, resentencing with a different prosecutor.
Of course. Absolutely.
And Mr. Anderson, with respect to the argument of the defense that the rebuttal witness discussed matters that should have been addressed during the government's case in chief, specifically the portion of the testimony of Officer Wu where he talks about the behavior or the attitude of the defendant at the time that he, or at least the way it's interpreted, at least, is that he was talking to the defendant and the defendant was being belligerent. And,
well, he refused to leave, yeah, I think, and twice.
Why would you contend that would be an appropriate subject matter during rebuttal?
I think it was just a response to that. It contained the totality of attacking the credibility, the defense credibility, that he didn't talk to the officer in the first place.
But didn't that go to the sort of gravamen of the defense essentially contending that it wasn't the defendant who was the aggressor, but instead it was Albert, and it was Albert that was calling out the defendant, it was Albert that was kicking him and punching him, and wouldn't the testimony of the officer
refuted that, perhaps?
Refute that?
Yeah.
In a fairly significant way.
Well, that you mean that he was just belligerent or drunk, Your Honor? I don't know, you know?
Well, not just belligerent, but that he's not following the repeated directives of an officer that he should stop engaging in behavior that might be considered to be offensive to others.
Yes, true. It perhaps went a little too far, but I think he was told, I think Officer Wu said, he saw two Micronesian males in the parking lot, one who had a ponytail. The first one left readily. The second one had to be asked twice. And that's kind of about it, I think.
And that's in the context of a case in which I think Ms. Kiku and also Ms. Arlen Elwin Moses, both were describing the incident in a way that would suggest that Mr. David, the defendant, was the aggressor.
Well, Your Honor, yes. Both recipient witnesses.
Saying that there was a conflict because the defendant obviously said he wasn't the first aggressor. Mm-hmm. So if you've got that direct conflict and then you have a police officer offering testimony as to the belligerent nature of the defendant at a time that the defendant's actually with the decedent, and it's not the decedent that's being identified as a person who's repeatedly being belligerent, perhaps that would be considered significant evidence that's being raised in rebuttal that could have been raised during the case in chief. But I guess you've conceded that. I guess the next question is, what's your position as to whether or not that did infect the fairness of the trial to the extent that plain error was committed and can't find that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, absolutely. Where there's a wealth of compelling evidence showing guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the admission or exclusion of evidence, when it's erroneous, is harmless.
All right, and what would that wealth of evidence be that would make up for this evidence that's being presented by the police officer?
Fine. It was quite clear that Mr. David was the aggressor in this case at the end. It seems like the case was all about them getting drunk and jockeying for superiority. They're engaging in fights here and there, defensive moves and things. Let me show you this. Let me show you that. The last one went down where they were both in the parking lot and they were sparring again. And by his own testimony, Mr. David reached for something and hit the decedent.
Well, he was explaining why he reached for it because he was theoretically feeling the need to defend himself because the...
May I continue?
Yeah.
After which, the decedent ran and was being pursued by Mr. David, and who hit him struck him in the back of the head. And then, when Mr. David was finally collapsed from loss of blood and is on his back, Mr. David approaches him with two rocks in his hand, straddles him, and is about to bash his head in, but for the ladies telling him to stop.
And the woman who he also, I think, concedes he used sort of aggressive behavior towards by threatening her.
That was one of the charges as well.
For which he was convicted of.
Assault 3, not assault 2.
Yes.
Mr. Anderson, when the question was first asked of Officer Wu as to what he relayed to that particular Micronesian male with a ponytail, that he was told, the answer was a female wanted them to leave. I just related to both males. They didn't live there. They needed to go. They needed to get out of the area. The follow-up question was, now the one with the ponytail, did he leave immediately? No, not immediately, but he left. And then there was an objection on another grounds when he asked, was asked, why is that? But the actual question that he didn't leave immediately was not objected to. Do you think that the defense attorney in this case adequately preserved or brought to the attention of the trial court the notion or the suggestion that the rebuttal had gone too far by talking about the defendant's refusal to leave?
I think he did. I think it was preserved. I think he wanted a 104 hearing. I recall. I'm not
before
sure.
Before.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. Yes. I'm so sorry. Did you finish your response?
I'm fine.
How did the officer, when he arrived, know that these individuals were Micronesian? As compared to Melanesian or Indonesian or Filipino? How did he know that they were Micronesian?
I don't know.
I was just curious.
Wait, he spoke to Arlen upstairs, and then...
Oh, I see, because he spoke to her first.
He did.
Okay,
he did.
Thank you.
Yes. Is there any issue that anyone has against, as to the impropriety of the rebuttal evidence?
What do you, please respond to the question that I directed to Mr. Jerome. If the state had sought to elicit testimony in direct examination, in its case in chief, from Officer Wu, that he had approached and had asked this individual to leave, and he refused to do so several times, and he had to keep telling him to leave, would that have required a 404B?
You know, I don't know, because it seems to be right on the edge there. You know, why he, I don't even know, I don't remember he was being belligerent. You know, I'm not sure, actually, and I'll defer to you folks. But I do know that these people were quite drunk, and he might have just not listened the first time. So it might not be a bad act at all. So I'm not sure. I don't think the record is very clear on that.
What about the suggestion that the offer of proof was incomplete or misleading, because the suggestion was that the officer would actually be able to identify the defendant as a person that he spoke with, and then that didn't happen during the course of the testimony?
No, it didn't. But I think that's clear circumstantially who those two men down in the parking lot were.
And what's your response to the argument made by Mr. Jerome in his application suggesting that the prosecuting attorney went too far in closing by referring to the officer going to
another
location where the defendant lived, and then making comments about the fact that might be taken to imply that he had identified the defendant as the person who lived there or had encountered him?
Well, actually, what he said was, a half an hour later, Wu was called back to the same address, and this time someone was dead, and he eventually learned there was a homicide, and that the suspect was over at Paliva Street.
Was there anything in the record to indicate that the suspect was over at Piva Street?
That's where he lived.
And then he said the
He said that's where he lived. That's where the defendant lived, with the Moses family and David families, I believe.
Okay, so the prosecuting attorney said, in summarizing what happened, Officer Wu went back. It was a different call, a defibrillator call, I assume. And he eventually found out this is a homicide. Someone died. And the suspect is over at Piva Street, meaning the same guy with the ponytail. And he goes over. But the thing is, now the implication of that is that the officer went over to Piva Street and perhaps encountered the defendant there, I guess, might be one implication. But there was an objection when that was the question was asked of Officer Wu, and the court didn't allow any testimony about Officer Wu going over.
No, it didn't allow testimony about someone was dead, that he learned it was a homicide. That's true. I can see that.
Or going over to Piva Street.
Or going over to where he went over half an hour later, hour and a half later.
Okay, so should we notice this as plain error because it's argument that goes beyond the facts of the case?
Well, I think it's harmless, Your Honor, as I've stated before. I think any error in the errors that I've heard, at least, appear to be harmless, beyond a reasonable doubt. But I agree, I concede that was an error. The prosecutor should not have argued that. The court precluded that evidence during Wu's rebuttal testimony. But, you know, also, this was never, the ICA, the purpose of cert is to examine the ICA's opinion, whether it's right or wrong. This was never raised before the ICA. So I think it's kind of waived. But, of course, you can notice the plain error if you would.
Very well, thank you.
And the basis I guess there's no issue as to the basis for the rebuttal evidence?
I thought we had been talking about the basis.
Why the court approved it. I thought we were talking more of the content of some of the things. But if that's okay, I'm fine. I'm done. Okay, nothing else?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Jerome, I'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal. We had pretty much asked questions throughout your last 5 minutes, so if you need up to that much, you can, but if you can keep it shorter, try.
Just because it was the last thing that was discussed, I did want to talk a little bit about the misconduct during closing argument, at least this instance of misconduct during closing argument. And it's true, and Mr. Anderson conceded that, you know, none of these facts are in evidence, and Justice Pollack brought up earlier, you know, this, you know, it's a question of whether or not the person with the ponytail he spoke to was in fact the defendant. And, you know, this is the prosecutor arguing to the jury, this is how we know the police officer spoke to the defendant. And he's arguing a bunch of stuff that A, is not in evidence, and then B, he eventually found out this is a homicide, somebody died, and the suspect is over at Eva Street, meaning that same guy with the ponytail. And that's, not only is that not in evidence, and the closing reports are attached to the pre-sentence investigation in this case.
Mr. Jerome, I'm looking at your application, and you talk about the sentencing hearing and the admission of the rebuttal witnesses. You're not addressing this particular, what you allege is error on the part of the court for a long time.
Well, we do raise in our cert application, we do say that the court can recognize plain error based on this prosecutorial misconduct as well as other numerous instances of prosecutorial misconduct in this case. And this also.
Is ICA plainly erred by not taking into consideration, even though you didn't raise it?
Yes. And this also goes to the question of whether or not, if the court determines that allowing the rebuttal evidence was improper, whether or not it was harmful.
Why is it not harmless, as Mr. Anderson argues, you know, albeit that the officer shouldn't have said these things, that the suspect is over there at, I've been calling it Paiva Street, meaning the same guy with the ponytail, and he goes over. Now, that's not in the record, but why is that not harmless in the bigger context of this trial?
Well, it's not that the officer didn't say that. It's that not only is that not in the record, but it's factually incorrect.
Well, the officer was told was not allowed to answer, so it's not in the record. And whether it's factually correct or not is really not something we can decide here necessarily. I know the report says something different is your position.
Well, but you have to say that the prosecutor, did he have a good faith basis to make this argument? And he does not.
And why is that not harmless? Because there was no objection, correct?
There was an objection immediately prior to this that the prosecutor was arguing facts not in evidence when the prosecutor started talking about
why miscellaneous public reports are prepared. So why is this not harmless?
This is not harmless because it goes to the essential question in this case of the defendant's credibility.
How so?
Because this is a self-defense case, and in every self-defense case, one of the key issues is whether or not the defendant's testimony is credible. But, and the jury obviously rejected self-defense in this case because they found the defendant guilty of manslaughter.
But the fact that the suspect is over at Paiva Street, same guy with the ponytail, and the officer goes over, how is that actual? Because that's where the prosecuting attorney went over the line.
Because this basically tells the jury, you can be 100% sure that the person the officer spoke to in the parking lot was the defendant.
But how would they conclude that? I mean, the officer testified, he never identifies, he when he's, during the, this almost says, based on this statement, which arguably can be taken in the way you're arguing it, but it requires the jury to kind of disregard all the testimony they heard because the officer was unable, the cross-examination was quite clear that the officer could not identify the person he spoke to. The only thing he remembered was that there was a ponytail.
Because there were objections during, the the officer's testimony, and the jury hears those objections, and it's been it was recognized in Rogan, it's been recognized many times, the prosecutor comes into a courtroom, and the jurors believe that he, A, is truthful because he represents the government, and B, has access to fact-finding tools that other people do not, that when the government says something happened during their closing argument, the jury is going to take that as being truthful.
But in fact, though, the defense counsel didn't argue the ID in his closing, did he? He didn't challenge that the officer had misidentified this individual. Isn't that right?
I mean, I think the defense counsel, as a matter of strategy, treated it as not that important an issue.
In fact, he actually took it and used it because his argument was the officer was there and he didn't see injuries on the defendant, and that was inconsistent with the testimony of the two percipient witnesses, correct?
But that doesn't make what the defense counsel argued does not make the prosecutor's misconduct harmless. Because he's arguing, A, we have evidence that never came to trial that demonstrates conclusively that this person he spoke to was in fact the defendant. So that impeaches the defendant's credibility.
And actually, his theory of his closing was that it was that he had made, the officer had made the defendant. He wanted to argue that because he wanted to say the officer was there, he talked to the defendant had no injuries, although the two percipient witnesses had told you, in essence, that injuries would have already happened to him. So he used that actually to great advantage by arguing that the officer was impeaching or testifying in a contradictory matter to the two main percipient witnesses. So if that's the backdrop, why should we take this as plain error?
Because the public defender is placed in a position where, because of the court's errors in allowing this testimony to come in the first place, because of the prosecutor's misconduct during closing argument and saying things happened that didn't happen or are not in evidence, he's placed in the position where he has to respond to that. And he's not going to make some kind of argument that doesn't account for this evidence or try to make it work for his case. But he's making the best of a bad situation because our position is the evidence should have never come in. And he wouldn't have had to deal with the issue.
Mr. Jerome, can you further explain why, assuming that this was error, that is the error that was committed in referring to facts not in evidence in closing, the error that was committed in allowing the rebuttal to move into the area of rebutting the self-defense, assuming all that, as Mr. Anderson has said, why wouldn't it be harmless given the fact that there seemed to be overwhelming evidence that this was in fact not a self-defense case because the defendant was, Mr. Anderson refers, for example, to his actions against Ms. Kiku, as well as the testimony of the defendant himself that he was involved in a fight. So why wouldn't we conclude that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, the prosecutor's arguing based on the point of, we're going to disregard all of the defendant's testimony that this was self-defense. He wants the court to determine that none of that testimony was credible and all of the direct examination of the state's witnesses was credible. And that's not this court's culiana. This court's culiana is to look at all of the evidence and decide, was the evidence in this case against the defendant so overwhelming that a reasonable juror could not have found it not guilty?
Well, you seem to be characterizing it in a way that would suggest that it wasn't so overwhelming. So what difference then did the testimony of Officer Wu make in that regard?
Because Officer Wu's testimony, as Justice Pollack pointed out, is one of the few examples that the state has where they can impeach the defendant's credibility. And then they use, not only do they argue in closing argument that about this evidence that's not in evidence to show that this is the person he talked to, but then immediately thereafter, but he looks at that report, he remembers the guy with the ponytail, the guy that I had to tell twice to leave. Is that the sign of a guy that's scared as he would have told us? That's the first signs, at least we have from Officer Wu, that we have a person who's not very cooperative who refuses to leave the premises. So then they're arguing it to show that the defendant is belligerent, that he's not cooperative, and that he refuses to listen to orders, which goes far beyond what it was allowed into this case for.
Mr. Jerome, any other points that you wish to make at this time?
No, I would just ask the court to remand this case for a new trial based on, A, the statements during sentencing, and then B, the repeated misconduct by the prosecuting attorney during closing argument, which we argue demonstrates that those statements at sentencing were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Very well. Thank you very much to both of our attorneys in this case. The court will take this matter under advisement.